So fish. We as European Jews, we eat fish together with dairy. Okay. But North African Jews, for example, anyone who follows the Sephardic Shulchan Aruch, they won't eat tuna. For example, tuna casserole, they won't touch it. Or you know, anything which is fish with dairy, they won't eat it. So when I was in yeshiva, we deliberately made sandwiches. A friend of mine and I, we would deliberately make sandwiches with tuna and cheese and eat them in front of these guys deliberately. No, because you know how this thing started. It was a typo. And the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in Avkat Rochel, which was one of his books, he writes that it's a typo. He's the owner of the book. He wrote the book. And he said, this is a typo. And everyone ignored him. And he said, I'm the owner of the book. I'm the one who actually wrote this. This is my opinion. Why are you ignoring me? And when you ask people, when you tell them, you know, it's a typo. Oh, yeah, we know it's a typo. So why did you decide anyhow to do it? Because we prefer to go the more strict way. Why invent things which were never told? Why, not enough?
No, I don't understand what you're saying. So what a typo? No, go back and explain
It was a typo.
What was a typo?
He wanted to say...
That interpretation?
No, he wanted to say something about that it's unhealthy to eat fish and dairy together. And it came out that it's forbidden to eat fish and dairy together. Something like that.
What year? What year is this? This is a rabbi in what year?
We're talking about the late 1400s. Dairy.
I was going to say.
Fish and dairy. Meat and dairy is actually the interpretation which is found in the Second Temple period already. Yep. Many Jewish groups held that opinion. Even the ones who did not follow the Pharisees held the opinion of not eating meat with dairy. Very interesting. There's a lot of these opinions that everyone thinks is Pharisaic and actually has nothing to do with the Pharisees. The Pharisees were, and people don't understand the history of things. The Pharisees were a small group out of an entire system. The Pharisees are the ones who prevailed in the end, the ones that made the right deals with the Romans and everything and got through.
Sure.
But they were not the only ones. There were only 6,000 Pharisees. There were another 4,500 Essenes and a few thousand Sadducees. And then millions of just regular people. You know, and what the regular people did was one thing. What the other people, what the Pharisees decided to do was another thing. And people think everything was like specific like this. And if you would have come out and seen what was going on, you would have realized it's more like what goes on today. This is this group and those people and that opinion and that and that. And he had, and basically if you take the what's called Judeo-Christian world, that was more or less what was going on then. It goes on today as well. There's that opinion, those people followed that. And it's there, Lunar Sabbath and whatever. And all this madness we have today existed even then. There's nothing new. None of the opinions we're seeing now from whoever is new, these were things that existed. We know there's a fact that they existed. We just don't have a complete picture of everything. That's the difference.
Sure.
But the reality they lived in was very similar to our reality.
I agree.
But it's the reality, you pick up Josephus, and he talks about three philosophies, or you pick up Jedediah, or also known as Philo, and you look at what he says, and there were opinions. But what did the average schmo do? The average schmo did whatever the average schmo did. Mm-hmm. If he paid attention to the rabbis or not, he paid attention to the priests, the Sadducee priests, or the Essenes, whatever. I think that people felt obligated to everyone. This is why, for example, we see in the New Testament, this confusion of what exactly is he a Pharisee? Is he a Sadducee? Is he saying this? Does he have a scene? He had everything because that was the reality people were in. He was an unaffiliated person. Sure. Essentially, he was probably a Pharisee, but there's certain... anti oral law inclinations, which I think was common amongst most people. And when you open up the Talmud in different places, you see that when they speak about the average Shmo, which they call the Am Haaretz, which just means a man of the land, a commoner, because the Pharisees were an intellectual elite. Doesn't mean they were rich. But there was some kind of intellectual elite, and they spoke kind of outside of the rest of the people, and sometimes even down at the common man. But on the other hand, they don't always do that. So,
Yeah, and it was an interesting point that Keith made recently. When he was talking about the realization of how much he didn't know. When the penny dropped for him, and he was, and he wanted to learn more Hebrew, wanted to revisit his Hebrew and learn more and revisit the Tanakh and the Torah and learn more and so on and so forth. And he said he felt kind of overwhelmed at how much he didn't know and how much he wanted to know. But then he read you know, in Deuteronomy, where it says that they shall come and hear the Torah read once every 7 years. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like a relief to him, because what was expected of the people was to hear it once every 7 years, and they'd talk about it and they'd become familiar with it, they'd teach it to their children. But how...
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that has to be looked at as well is it really enough just to hear it once every 7 years? And it also raises the question of, so what was the job of the priests and the Levites and the elders in cities?
Well, that's
and I
true.
I think it was more than that. I don't think there's an obligation of the average schmo. I don't know if average schmo is the correct thing to say, but I don't think there's an obligation of the average person to sit and read all the time. This scholarly mindset.
That's my point.
Is really a Second Temple thing that developed.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Torah is really to do. It's
that's right. That's right. And I guess the point that I'm making is that the minimum, at the very least, you would hear it, you know, once every 7 years. But you are, you know, at the other end of the scale, you may be scrutinizing every minute of the day, you know, trying to dig deeper and find the hidden meaning of what's actually in the text.
But who says there's a hidden meaning? Who says we have to look at everything as a hidden meaning? It's a lot of rubbish, this thing. This is a Greco mindset. I actually had a friend over here during Shabbat, and he was going through my books, and I hope he left that book in its rightful place. Where is it? I don't see it now. I hope he didn't take it with him. No, it's over here. Okay, he didn't take it with him. Yeah. If he would have, I would have taken his head off. No. and I was just like, where is it? I remember it was on that shelf. Where is it? Because I'm actually sitting in my living room with many of my books in front of me. So if there's anything, sure. I need to just get up and pick it. And it basically goes over this was a book written by Saul Lieberman, who was an amazing scholar. About Second Temple period writings, stuff like that. And there was a period of time when I was studying a lot about the Second Temple period just to try to figure out what was going on there. And he wrote this book about the Greek influence of the Jewish mind. And he points out a very interesting thing. There's a whole chapter there where he talks about the mechanism of oral law. And he goes about it and basically shows that everything you see there, all the elements of the 13 attributes of 3, 7, 13, and then 32 all really are, the 7 are really an offshot of the 3, and the 13 are an offshot of the 7, and what is it, 7 and then 13, there's supposed to be 3 as well, like the earliest one it was 3, and they're offshots of one another, mm-hmm. but really this whole thing of over-scrutinizing and everything, it just doesn't make sense. I think that the only thing that can, but because I always say that, and then I realize there are a few other things I can look at. But one of the things that we do have to pay attention to is the reality that certain law cases, for example, are never strictly, you can't strictly buy the word, because the Torah gives you examples of possibilities and gives you a general idea of how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's your job as a judge, it's your job as an elder, as a Levite, as a Kohen, whatever it is, to make the decision based on what the Torah gives you, and then you actually do have to dissect and scrutinize sometimes, and dissect it to a point where you just figure out exactly what happened and then compare it to an exact case and everything. Mm. So the one of the arguments I heard many, many times, and I think it's one of the arguments I used years ago when I was like 16 or something, was that oral law is real because, we can't have all the examples of everything that can happen. And I think this is where we have to divide up the oral law into several categories. And one of the categories we have to look at is the oral law as a separate entity, mm-hmm. where we have rules and regulations that actually contradict the written word.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the...
Not always, obviously, but sometimes.
But I'm talking about a specific type.
Sure.
If we divide it up into oral law into several groups, we actually have to look at several things. There is the interpretation of the word,
mm-hmm.
which is one thing, and that's not necessarily oral law. That can actually be written law, but we confuse it with oral law because we think that everything that the sages say is oral law. But really, it's interpretation. What's very, very interesting is if you open up the what's called the Midrash Halacha, you'll find a lot of things that will contain interpretations which would be very, very similar to, say, Karaite interpretation or the actual strict meaning of the word. That's mm-hmm. one thing. Then you have the manipulation of text, which is already something completely different. Mm-hmm. where we scrutinize the text based on certain rules, that's where oral law really starts bursting out. And then we have saying of the elders, or the decrees of the elders, the decrees of the rabbis, which is a completely separate entity from the Torah in general. It has nothing to do with the Torah. It has to do with understandings they had, everything. But the thing is, when I was taught, I mean, I majored in Jewish philosophy and Jewish tradition in high school. I actually got an A+ on that one. It was kind of cool. He was a very, very good teacher. He explained it so well, and it was a subject that always interested me. You know, how do we understand ourselves as Jews, but also as people who follow the Bible? And I always saw the problems here and there. I mean, there was always an issue. So I started digging into it. So I would spend my afternoons during Shabbat studying Bible and reading Jewish philosophy, trying to figure out, you know, how do I put these two together. And how do I put, you know, Jewish law into the Bible as well? Because it's really all when we started philosophy, it wasn't just philosophy, you know, it wasn't just only just Maimonides or Rav Saadia Gaon or whatever it would be. You know, we learned mostly the old philosophy. We didn't learn the latter philosophy. You know, we had a bit of Rav Kook. A little bit of Rav Kook as well, because he was also a philosopher. But we never really went beyond the 14th century, I think it was. 14th, 15th century, I don't think we ever went beyond that. But what was very, very interesting is that I realized at one point that this argument of, you know, putting oral law and everything that the rabbi said, turning to saying it's actually law. There's even an interesting statement in the Talmud at one point but we reach a point where the Talmud says he who says not to recite the Shema is to be put to death. But we don't have a commandment in the Torah. I mean, putting people to death on different things. It's not that they mean to be put to death. What they mean is it's a very problematic thing that you're arguing with us as rabbis. And I think that's over self-empowerment. I mean, again, I come from an Orthodox background. I can't argue that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I will probably always have my strong appeals towards Orthodoxy, and I follow most of what I do is based on Orthodox Judaism. Sure. But I have to admit that this stuff that doesn't necessarily work, and I'm not the only one who asked that question. I know a lot of people like me, you know, and if you look at it, for example, Nehemiah comes from an Orthodox background. I was Orthodox way longer than Nehemiah, but he came from a very, very similar background. I mean, both our fathers, his father, Alav Shalom, may he rest in peace, was a rabbi. My father's a rabbi. Mm-hmm. Both our fathers were diabetics, by the way, which is kind of scary. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, and we both saw very similar things. It took me many, many years to decide to realize that, you know, there's something wrong. But the question was there for years and years, and I'm not the only one I've met. I mean, there were in one of the yeshivot I used to go to, we actually had one guy who was kicked out because he was vocal about his opinions. And he actually met up with me, and he said to me, "What do you think?" I said, "I think you're right." Mm. But I said to him, you know, certain questions he was asking were true. You know, and there's nothing about it. And there's a lot of there's a lot of books that came out about trying to prove the oral law, and most of it just doesn't work. There's no real good arguments, but I'll put it this: I listen to arguments by a person who's actually a logician, a man who works on logic, and his arguments. I sat there listening to some of the arguments and everything, and I basically went shrug, because one of the major things. This is one of the things I actually did learn in philosophy in general, is that there's an issue with absolute truth. And there's an issue with the subjectivity. A person is not really subjective. Everything that we act upon, everything that we do is with a bias. Mm-hmm. And therefore, sometimes when we make a certain argument, we will not be able to see where we're wrong. Now, that's that thing I learned years ago. That's something I learned years ago when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And this is why in every single discussion or argument that exists in the world, each end thinks they're right. Mm-hmm. And even if one end makes a very good argument, it doesn't necessarily mean that end is correct. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, I don't argue that much these days with people because I prefer to listen these days. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a discussion, for example, when I was in philosophy classes regarding how do you decide something is a true, is correct or not? And one of the arguments that was brought up was, if the majority of the group that has a discussion is convinced that it's true. Now, we said, okay, now what does that mean? Oh, what it means is that the majority of, for example, Jews around the world do believe that Pharisaic Judaism, or what we follow today as Orthodox Judaism, is the authentic Judaism. Now, is that true or not? Now, I won't be surprised if a lot of people listening to this recording are like, no, of course it's not. And that's the thing. So we really have to realize in every argument, even if the majority of people hold by a certain opinion. Now, obviously, a lot of people out there also, for example, came out from the, from Christianity and say, well, obviously, you know, we have a lot of people believe in Yeshua in a certain way, and we know it's incorrect, that way of belief. And mm-hmm. I agree with them, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's basically a problem. You can never know 100% if you're right or wrong until you bring it forth in front of a lot of people and there's a discussion. But even if the majority of people agree on a certain opinion, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be right, because there's always circumstantial information that can show up. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's a wonderful verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs, that says, "Tzadik harishon berivo uvareoch karo." The first man is righteous in his argument, and his friend comes over and questions him. So it's basically an issue that we always have to learn and try to understand what exactly is going on. And we can never say we have the absolute truth. There is some absolute truth. If we believe in God, there's an absolute truth. Do we hold that absolute truth? I think the answer is yes. We have the Torah. Now, interpreting the Torah into its absolute meaning, that's where we have a problem. But there are, I think there are things that we can deal with, which are, you know, we can actually show that they're incorrect. Just as an example, you know,
yeah, it's touching. Choosing an example is a bit touchy.
I'm trying to choose an example that won't trod on too many people, and I can't think of one.
No, we best not. But as we've said many times before on the program, always reserve as far as your conclusions are concerned, to the listeners, always reserve the right to be wrong. Always reserve the right to change your mind or be proven wrong. And in doing so, you have to extend grace to your fellow man that he may be right. And so really, instead of looking at whether we're right or wrong or whether we agree in our conclusions, look to see if that person, though they might think a little differently to you, look to see if they are being true to their to the conclusion that they've arrived at, true to their integrity, if they're being sincere, because that's a thing you can respect. Just because it's a different conclusion to yourself, it's still a quality about that person that you can respect.
Exactly. Now, how do we tie this up with Judges 19?
I think
it's very, very simple. The integrity of the characters in the story is very, very questionable. The people here, instead of practicing righteousness and good judgment with people, there's a lot of lying going on in this story. There's a lot of deception. There's a lot of deception in the story. And I think there's also another interesting thing that I noticed. I read it in one of the books I have here. So someone said there that there's also a certain level of polemics here against, first of all, against an organized system. Because this is in this chapter, in the next chapter, we actually have for the first time the concept of the elders of the nation, the elders of the Edah, Ziknei Edah. It's the first time we see that. And as I mentioned last week, I'm sure when this recording will come up, we spoke about the issue of the polemics against certain organized systems which are hinted here. And one of the ideas that I actually read was that there's a polemic here against the family of Saul, which we're going to bump into in the next book, because they're basically saying, well, the tribe of Benjamin, which happens to be the tribe of King Saul, King Saul, we're not very nice people.
Yeah, let's be honest. I mean, we've been schmoozing for, I don't know, over half an hour now, and frankly, this is the chapter in Judges that we were hoping not to get to.
I think the story here is brought here in the end to show you the problem of the subject we just schmoozed about, that when we're not honest about what we're doing, when we're not realizing that to solve problems, we don't have to be each other's throats, but we have to listen, this is what can happen. So there's a certain element here of pro-system, saying we have to get ourselves organized finally. You know, we have to really put everything down, mm-hmm. put all the arguments on the table and deal with them. We have to be united. So they try to get united, but they unite under the wrong flag. And they start killing one another. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing I'm always afraid of. You know, I've seen violence. No, I'm not talking just, you know, just people arguing. I have seen physical violence in between people mm-hmm. that are arguing. I have seen people go up, for example, the Karaite synagogue and spit on the entrance.
Oh, yeah, that's not right.
You know, I used to live in the old city, and I've seen that happen. Yes. I've seen Christians, I've seen either Christians or people believe in Yeshua from different perspectives, mm-hmm. have actual very loud, almost violent arguments with one another. I have seen fist fights mm-hmm. in between people over certain things. Mm-hmm. And it's like you try to unite under a flag, you try to figure out, you know, what is the truth, and you lose focus on other things. And, you know, sometimes you think you have your truth, but you might be wrong. And one of the ways of knowing you're wrong is if you bring disaster on everyone. Now, again, certain disasters, if we have, for example, a prophet like Jeremiah who says, if you do X, Y, Z, you know, that can happen. You know, if you have someone who's actually a prophet telling you the truth, sure. That's one thing. But again, how do you scrutinize who a prophet is? How do you decide what's truth and what's not truth? And that's another issue. I mean, Jeremiah has these discussions, and hopefully, you know, God willing, we'll actually get to Jeremiah. You know, hopefully we'll get there. You know, that's my plan. I'm planning on going all the way through the end of the prophets. I don't know what you're planning on.
I'm not going to do it by myself.
Exactly. And Jeremiah himself is dealing with false prophets. You know, so again, not every time you have someone who claims they had revelation or someone says, you know, God has spoken to me. You tell them, so give me proof. You know, we have this in Deuteronomy. We just had this. Where you go and says, you know, how do you know it's a true prophet? Tell something and see if it happens. Jeremiah uses the exact same argument mm-hmm. when he goes in with the yoke on his shoulders, and he says to the other prophet, says, you know, if you're a real prophet, you tell us what's going to happen, mm-hmm. and if it happens, what we do, you know, we have the truth. So we have to be very, very careful. And this is kind of what's going on here. We also have an issue here with, for example, when they go out to war, there's an issue of how God speaks to them. It's kind of shady sometimes. We'll talk about it when we get there. And what's even worse in the story, and I'm sorry I'm cutting you off, but what's even worse in the story is that there's a Levite involved. I mean, you're again, another Levite. You're in charge of the Torah. You're in charge of teaching the people, and you pulling this stunt? What is this? What are you doing? And really, really, we have a big, big, big problem here. So actually, anything you want to say before we start?
No, I was just going to say, you mentioned Deuteronomy 13. We will actually be revisiting that while we're doing this chapter, but obviously Judges chapter 19. And now that we're almost at the end of the program, I should probably introduce you and let everyone know that you've tuned into the right program. It is Light of the Prophets and with Yoel Ben Shlomo, and we are up to Judges 19.
Wait. I thought that these days I'm referred to as Yoel Halevi.
Yoel Halevi. You want me to change it this late in the?
No, yeah. we'll keep it as Yoel.
The stage name is Yoel Ben Shlomo. And so anyway, Judges 19, and of course it doesn't stop there. The story does continue on into Judges 20. We're going to do that next week. But what I'm thinking, Yoel, let me just read it through, just at least until, let's say, 21, from 1 to 21.
Narrate almost the whole chapter?
I want to read it because we will come back to certain points. Well, I'll tell you what, you interrupt me when you want to interject, but it begins like this. This is the way it starts. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain
What's interesting is that the book ends with the same verse, and it here specifically in these chapters, at least another time. This here, There's another place where he mentions this, and then in the end, the last verse it says that as well.
It's,
and
it's mentioned this, a number this of is, times. It's like the disclaimer. It's like, now remember, I know this is really, really messed up, but hey, there was no king in Israel, all right? So cut us some slack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's no king in Israel. There was a certain Levite. Now, there's no reason to think that this guy wasn't a Levite here in 19 as there was in 17 and 18. Yeah.
But here is clearly introduced as a Levite, end of story.
End of story. Staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And we've talked about concubines before and what they are. But it says his concubine, she played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah. And she was there for 4 months. And
no, this is very interesting. First of all, you know, it says Batizne. And he says she played the harlot, but it doesn't mean that she did anything. It doesn't seem that she did anything which was forbidden. She just got up and left. Yeah. You know what's very strange here, and this kind of starts showing us a bit about the character of this Levite. He's as we can see, he's one piece of work. This guy, she leaves for 4 months. Mm. Suddenly he remembers that she's gone. I mean, if my wife were to get up and left, or my concubine, got up and left, I would be chasing her down the road. He's waiting for 4 months.
Yeah. So it's, but we don't really know why, but it is interesting. I mean, 4 months later, husband arose.
He might have been a really, really, really nasty man.
The next verse says he went to her to speak kindly to her and bring her back.
Well, he might have been a wife beater. He might have been a really, really horrible man. Oh, and after 4 months, it's her problem. He might have been complaining. It's her problem. It's her fault. Everything's wrong with her. And then suddenly after 4 months, he suddenly remembered that he kind of loves her. Maybe he likes her a bit. And, but she is my concubine. I should go back and be nice to her. I think it suddenly dawns on him that he shouldn't be.
That's a good point, because that you're right. That would explain the distance of time between her leaving and him going to find her. Okay. So we don't know what it means that she played harlot. We don't know specifically what she did. But in any case, 4 months, and he goes to speak kindly to her and bring her back. And having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him, so he arrives, and she brought him into her father's house. And the father of the young woman saw him, and he was glad to meet him. And now his father-in-law, now it's interesting, he's referred to as his father-in-law of the concubine, and the young woman's father detained him. And so he stayed with him 3 days, and so they ate and drank, and they lodged there together. And it came to pass on the fourth day that he arose in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to the son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterwards go your way. And so they sat down, the two of them, they ate and they drank. And then the young woman's father said to the man, please be content to stay all night, and let your heart be merry. And the man stood to depart, but his father-in-law urged him, and so he lodged there.
To tell the truth, I don't really understand what he's trying to do. I have to admit something. I do not understand what exactly is he trying to play here. He might be very, very concerned for his daughter. So he's trying to, maybe lure him to stay there with him permanently, so he can keep an eye open on his daughter. Maybe part of it has to do with, I'm being very generous to you. You take care of her. That might be the other. He might be hinting to him, or he might be like trying to make sure that his daughter just came back. He sold her as a concubine. He doesn't want this to happen again. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to make sure that first of all, maybe get his daughter to see, look, he's a nice guy. He's been here for a couple of days. Look how he's behaving. I like him. He's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. It can be a whole bunch of things. He's playing with something here, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because this covers several verses. So there's something we have to pay attention to here.
This is true because when I was reading this, I thought, okay, so we've gone the third day, fourth day, fifth day. Now we're in the fifth day. He arises early in the morning on the fifth day, but the young woman's father said, please, refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. And you're right, there's something going on here, and it's more than just the fact that he was detained beyond the time that he was hoping to get home. It's not as if he suspected there was going to be some sort of ill will on the way home. But there's something going on there. It's trying to convey something to us in those verses.
Exactly, and it's not clear what it is. But I'm just looking at him, looking. It's like, what is going on here? And it's very, very strange. And they actually, there's no commentary that actually tells you, okay, here's an idea of what's going on. So whatever I just said here, just purely from me, I just pull it out of my head. Because really, there's nothing really clear. Why are we spending so many verses just on this issue of him being detained for several days?
And isn't this an excellent example? Because you can't help, I'll tell you this, Yoel, and I'm sure this has happened to you as well, as you read these verses, you think, man, this is a crazy story. And there's detail in such little things that seem so trivial, but how can they be trivial when they go on for so many verses? And you think to yourself, is there some kind of larger understanding? Is there some kind of maybe prophetic understanding? Or is there something bigger than what we're reading here? And you start to speculate. You start to scrutinize and you start to speculate, but neither you or me are going to open our mouth and probably discuss the things, the possible conclusions that we came to, because there's such little to base it on. Mm-hmm, but exactly. But sometimes people will take this and base whole teachings about it, and then other people will hear those whole teachings. Well, that's what it means, you know, such and such said that, and it makes perfect sense to me. That must be what it means. And they'll take that and they'll tell a friend, and the friend goes, oh, this is a fact. This is what it means. It means this. And then all of a sudden, a tradition has developed, and it's hanging on a spider web. It is interesting. There are verses here that are difficult to explain, but you cannot help but to be forced to consider that they have a deeper meaning.
Yeah, I mean, an example I dealt with quite a few years ago was an argument regarding the Book of Numbers. There's a lot of numbers, a lot of counting of the people.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of Kabbalists came up with these ideas. Oh, it has secret meanings and everything. And, you know, I basically said, you know, what Maimonides says is like, no, it's just numbers. There's nothing, no secrets here, nothing. He's just telling you how many people were there. And there's actually a logic there that it's counting the people to show, you know, like the sage has said, he's counting the people to show how much he loves them. So he counts them down to the last person.
So let it be what it is.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, I've noticed this, what you just described, I've noticed it as well. I mean, it's mutual in the Jewish world and the Christian and Messianic world. You know, it's mutual. We have this with all our groups that, you know, someone says something, it can be a lot of nonsense, but someone says something and it could be a teacher or it can be an individual and they say it and it develops and whatever nonsense that person said becomes truth. So I have a saying, it doesn't matter. If something is nonsense, it doesn't matter who said it, it's still nonsense.
Sure. Sure enough. And so, you know, this is a passage with a few. Boy, I tell you what, I'm guessing, Yoel. I admit I'm guessing, but I bet there's an interesting interpretation from the Kabbalists in regards to this passage, because there's a few numbers there to talk with.
I won't be surprised.
You'll be surprised. Verse 9, and when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, look, the day is now drawing to evening. Please spend the night. See, day is coming to an end, lodge here that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow you may go early so that you can go home. However, the man was not willing.
I'm actually strongly inclined that he officially owns, you know, quote unquote, but that's how they saw it. And I think her father is trying to protect her. She might have told him what happened, and he's trying to protect me. He's trying to stall time. Another idea came in my head was that he's trying to stall time. He might stay there. Or he might get up, you know, get fed up with her father, decide to divorce her, because there is, I think concubines, there is a certain element, they have to divorce her in a certain way. I'm not too sure, but divorce her and let her be. He's maybe trying to protect his daughter here. He's trying to, you know, literally make him mad, where he'll be angry with him as well, and then just, you know, I'm fed up with this, you know, just keep your daughter, I divorce her, whatever it is, get up and leave. But it doesn't happen.
Maybe.
He's persistent. Yeah, he's very persistent.
He is persistent. The man was not willing to stay that night, and so he arose and departed and came to where?
They basically decide that they will go, and they reach near the city of Yevus, which is known as Yerushalayim. So this is the second time we have the name Yerushalayim mentioned in the Book of Judges. And it's called the city of Yevus. It's also called Yerushalayim. What's very interesting about the name Yerushalayim, it's also found as Urushlam in certain texts, specifically Egyptian texts. So this is the old name, which kind of pulls out the rug underneath a certain midrash. I remember years ago studying this midrash that said the name Yerushalayim is a combination of the word Shalem, the original name. They presume, you know, if Shalem is Yerushalayim, Shalem from story with the Melchizedek and Abraham, if it's actually Jerusalem, it's a good question. A combination of Hashem Bahar Yira'eh, that's how Abraham calls Mount Moriah, the place where God is Nira'ah, Yira'eh. And also Shalem, so they say, oh, it's Yerushalayim, that's the name, but really Yerushalayim is a very, very old name found in very old texts as well. But it's also called Yevus because the Jebusites were living there. And it's actually saying, well, it's Yevus, at this point was called Yevus, which actually happens to be Jerusalem.
Can I interrupt you for a minute? Because you said this is the second time that it's mentioned in Judges. If I remember correctly, is it Adoni Zedek? Is that the first time that we hear about it? He was the king of Jerusalem at the time?
No, Adoni Bezek was the, if I remember correctly, was actually the king of, Adoni Tzedek was the king of Bezek or something, no? Adoni Bezek, no, sorry, his name was Adoni Bezek, and he was the king...
No, I'm thinking of Joshua. It's mentioned in Joshua, and it's...
Maybe it isn't. I think I'm wrong.
Let me find it.
Now we're confused.
Now we're confused already. No. It is. It's Adoni Zedek. I'm sure he was the king of Jerusalem.
Yeah. No. Here. It says here in verse 7, and Adoni Zedek said 70 kings were with their thumbs of their hands and their feet cut off. And they were collecting food underneath my table, which I have done, as I have done, and though as God has given me, and they went to Jerusalem, and he died there.
What chapter? You're in chapter where?
Chapter 1, verse 7. It mentions Jerusalem there.
Oh, chapter 1, verse 7 in Judges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
But it does mention, I think we did speak about another place where it says, it might be chapter 3 as well, so this might be the third time that Jerusalem is mentioned.
I'm thinking of Joshua chapter 10, verse 1. It came to pass when Adoni Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, and so on and so forth. That's where I'm thinking. Okay, so we have Jerusalem mentioned there in Joshua chapter 10, but what you're saying is that the Judges chapter 1...
mentions Jerusalem.
In verse 7, it mentions Jerusalem. Oh, and that's Adoni Bezek. Sorry, you're absolutely right.
Adoni Bezek.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, it does too, and you're absolutely right. They brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Okay, this is the guy that was cutting off everyone's thumbs and toes, right?
Exactly.
All right.
By the way, in Hebrew, there's no thumbs and toes. You know, it's there's the bohen, which is the thumb, and then the big toe in your foot is also referred to as a bohen. And we don't have a word in Hebrew for toes. We just say it's ba'ot raglaim, the fingers of the feet.
There you go.
Do you know that your pinky? Do you know that the pinky in your foot, the little finger in your foot, is actually very important for your balance when you walk?
I don't doubt it. I've never tried to walk without it.
No, because it keeps the balance. I actually looked into something about it. We actually need the toes and everything to keep the balance of walking, specifically the little one. It keeps the outer part of your foot at bay. It actually controls it. It's kind of a break.
We're fearfully and wonderfully made, and I'm sure all of our bits serve a purpose. Where are we?
There's a verse in Job, "Besari echezeh Elohav, my flesh I will see God." Is it Job or is it?
No, it is Job. Job says that. That's right.
It's Job. Yeah, "Besari echezeh Elohav."
Amen. So here it is, Jerusalem. Okay, but and it says they came to Yevus, and with him were two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. And they were near Yevus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, "Oh, come, please, let's turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." But his master said to him, "No, it would have been great. I mean, that would have been the end of the chapter, and we could all go home."
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not the children of Israel. We will go." Oh, now that's
the irony. This is the irony. Well, but we won't sit with these Gentiles, but we'll go and sit with the Jews. And with the Jews, it became the Israelite. That's when all hell broke loose.
Yeah,
it's emphasizing the irony.
Where is the verse that talks about? Oh no, I've got to find that as well. Hold on one second.
What verse?
Okay, so there's a verse that talks about how they could not conquer Jerusalem, and that they lived in with Judah to this day.
So I've been looking for it as well.
No, it's Joshua. Joshua 5. It's the end of Joshua chapter 15. Okay, so it says, As for the Jebusites, this is the last verse 63, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out, but the Jebusites lived with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. And so here we are in Judges, and lo and behold, they're still there. And the servant says, come on, let's crash here. And he says, no, I'm not going to crash here. These guys aren't even the children of Israel. They're a city of foreigners. We'll go on to Gibeah. And so he said to his servant, come, you know, let us draw near to one of those places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed by and they went away. And the sun was going
down. By the way, in Judges 1, verse 21, yeah, it says, and the Jebusites dwell of Jerusalem, the children of Benjamin were not able to inherit. And the Jebusites sat amongst the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem until this very day. So this is the third time Jerusalem is mentioned in the book of Judges. See? We have it chapter 1, verse 7, and then chapter 1, verse 21. I remembered the verse like that, and I was looking for it.
No, that's really interesting. So in Joshua, it says, so they lived with the inhabitants of Judah to this very day. In Judges, it says they lived with the inhabitants of Benjamin to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, anyway, if you remember, it's on the border. Jerusalem is kind of on the border. There's actually a midrash that says Jerusalem was specifically chosen because it was in between two different tribes.
Right. Okay, fair enough. And so so they keep going, and they come to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, and they turned aside, and they went to lodge there, and he went in, they sat down in the open square of the city, but no one, you know, was game to take them into his house to spend the night, so there they are. Yeah, well, the sun's going down,
and if you ever lived in a Mediterranean place, you know, where the ancient customs existed, if you saw a stranger in the street, you have to welcome into your house, because the moment someone enters the gates of your city, and I'm gonna use a terminology, some people are gonna go like, ooh, interesting, but there's a concept where if one enters the gates of your city, he is under the protection of that city, and we can call it covenant if some people really want to insist on that one. And really, now he's under your protection. It's a job of the people, the dwellers of the city, to bring them into their house, but everyone's ignoring them. Now, this is completely against custom. It's against everything.
But see, maybe they knew what would happen. The last thing you want is, you know, what happens. You know, a bunch of these people beating down your door trying to... I mean, maybe they knew that it's best to leave the foreigner alone. They just wanted to go home and mind their own business. We don't know, but...
It could be.
It's creepy, but in any case, an old man came from his work in the field in the evening. He was from the mountains of Ephraim, and so he wasn't a Benjamite. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place, were Benjamites. And when he raised his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city, the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" And so he explains it to him. And he says,
"The combination beginning of verse 17 is Vaisaina Vayar." And there's a lot of jokes that go in the Orthodox world, in the Jewish world. What is, oh, everyone was walking with their eyes in the ground, and suddenly they lifted their eyes. Suddenly, you know, they lifted their eyes by divine intervention. But it isn't, Vaisaina Vayal, it actually means that he noticed them. He was walking, minding his own business, and he's looking around, and he suddenly notices. That's really what the text is saying. So Vaisaina Vayal is actually a three-word combination that appears quite frequently when someone suddenly notices something.
Right. Okay. So he knows that he invites them back. And I mean, he explains where he's from, and he's got his concubine, he's got his servants, he's got his donkeys and everything. And the old man basically says, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." So he brought them back to his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Now, if it were possible, Yoel, if we could just stop there and we could say, you know, next week,
peace on
Judges chapter 20, peace on you. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of the Father's word. That was a nice story. In the end, they found a place to stay, and that's good hospitality, and we like that. But we can't.
Yeah, but there's always a twist.
There's always a twist. Verse 22, what happens?
So they're sitting there having a good time, you know, drinking. It says, metivim et libam. So metivim et libam can also mean that they're talking there and they're having an interesting conversation. They might be drinking something. Yes, alcohol is allowed according to the Torah unless you're a Nazirite or Kohen.
Mm-hmm.
Kohen in service or high priest at all times. And suddenly the people of the city, people of Belial, there's a lot of discussions what Belial means. There's a lot of...
Well, we'd just remind the listeners, if they go to the Torah Pills, on Deuteronomy chapter 13, and this is where I was saying we're going to return to chapter 13 of Deuteronomy. Nehemiah did go into some detail regarding that word. And that verse, chapter 13, verse 13, Deuteronomy 13:13, corrupt men is what I've got. Corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of the city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known. It's the same word here, Belial, and it is in this, in mine, it is in that particular verse, it says perverted men in Judges 19:22. So corrupt men or perverted men. I think if I remember correctly, Nehemiah is explaining how it could probably mean men without the yoke of the Torah. Lawless exactly. men. Lawless men.
There's a rabbinic interpretation that says that Bli'ol. Bli is without, ol is a yoke, and basically Belial is a combination. Essentially what it means is a person who is lawless, a person who doesn't care, a person who just is not interested. But it's interesting what you're saying here, because what it brings up here is that it could be that the people of Yiv'ah were okay people, but there were a group of bullies there who were bullying the entire village. And that goes back to what you said. No one wanted to collect them in because they knew if we take them in, if any of the bullies hear this, they will start breaking down our door and trying to rape and steal and pillage and whatever. Mm. And people were actually scared out of their minds. And what's interesting here is a small group of individuals, this Levi and these bullies, they bring massive disaster on the people of Israel. Mm. By the actions of singular people, it destroys it. Takes us back to the story in Joshua about Achan, that because he stole from Jericho, he brought disaster on the whole people of Israel. And it's a very, very interesting discussion that exists in the rabbinic world regarding the responsibility of all Jews to one another, all Israelites to one another through behavior, through actions. And I think that this story could have been one story out of many other stories that existed at the time, but this one was like the worst of the worst. Mm. But it's also trying to teach us that you really have to have control over certain things. And this is, it's trying to basically show you, maybe trying to show you that if there was an authority at the time, if there were a king, then all the king had to do is send his soldiers and start arresting. Mm-hmm. But because there's no authority, even a small group of people can bring a massive disaster on the entire nation.
And there's a point, by the way. We don't actually know how many men, these men of Belial, we don't know. I mean, there might have been 5. There might have been 4. There might have been 40. We don't really know. But in any case, they surrounded the house and beat on the door, and they spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the men who came to your house, bring out the men, that we may know him. Now, I have in italics there, that we may know him carnally. They want to rape him.
They want to rape him. That's usually the, you know, some people might say, oh, so we know who he is. You know, have you, who you brought to your house?
Yeah, hey, how you going? My name's Jim, and this is Fred, and nice to meet you.
Yeah, but the regular interpretation means to rape.
Yeah.
But we do have other places. We do have other places where it uses the root of yada for torture as well. We had it with one of the judges where he took the thorns of the desert, mm-hmm. and he knew them with the thorns Gideon. Of the desert. It's in chapter 8, verse 16. Yep. And he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the desert and the barkanim, which are big thorns, and he knew them, or he made them know them. Oy. It's vayodabahim, which is a certain way where it's...
The combination of those meanings don't serve the imagination. Okay.
So it might be that they just wanted to beat him up. I mean, it can be either that they wanted to rape him or mm-hmm. they wanted to beat up. Because the reason we usually say rape here is because in the end they rape the concubine.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's by association. That's true. And it's not necessarily what they were going to do to him. But you can be forgiven to coming to that conclusion. I guess it's the most obvious. But it says the man, now this is, okay, Yoel, you got to help me out here. There must be some secret Hebrew understanding to this, because I know
probably
this.
Isn't.
No, you got to make something up, because this appears twice. We've got it in Bereshit as well. It says, but the man, the master of the house, went out to them and he said to them, no, my brethren, I beg of you, do not act so wickedly, seeing this man has come into my house. Do not commit this outrage. Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Knock yourself out. Please tell me there's some other interpretation.
There isn't.
What is it? What does it
there
mean?
Isn't. There isn't. He's trying to protect this man by saying, okay, if they have a sexual relation with these two women, maybe it will calm them. Maybe it will please them. You know.
So maybe, can I? This is like I really pondered this, and I pondered this last time when I was reading it in Genesis 19, Bereshit 19, because the same thing happens, and it says, please, brethren. Okay, so this is verse 7. Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See, now I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please, let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since now these are the two messengers, right, that went to Sodom, since this is the reason they have come under my shadow, under the shadow of my roof. So he offers the men of Sodom, he offers his two virgin daughters just so that he doesn't commit the abomination that is potentially sodomy or raping of men. Is it because the homosexual act or the violent act, the violence of rape, is so much more abhorrent than the rape of a woman? I mean, we can't say that.
Well, first of all, she's his concubine, which means she's kind of a wife. That's also forbidden.
Sure.
You have to remember that. But
to offer, I mean, look.
But I think. First of all, we have to look at the fact that he's brought this man into his house. You know, he's under his protection, but he's an old man. There's nothing he can do. So he's trying to find the simplest solution. So, you know, if we say it's rape, then it is. You know, so he's basically saying, okay, laying with a man is really, really bad. It's an abomination, but. You know, if it's a woman, it's still normal. It somehow goes into the realm of normal, quote unquote, as normal as we can say in these verses, in these insane stories.
Less of an abomination, perhaps.
Exactly.
Is that what he's thinking?
He's just trying to, you know, he's trying to salvage the situation. He's saying, okay, so maybe if we do this, you know, there's nothing he can do. He's surrounded.
Okay, so like,
I'm thinking because I've got
a daughter, right? Now, let's say you come and you stay in my place, right? And then something like this happens. There's no way you would even, I mean, I wouldn't, and there's no way you would even let me give them my daughter. You and I would be grabbing the baseball bats, and you and I would go out there and deal with the situation.
You're only thinking of baseball bats? I was already thinking of pulling out a shotgun. But anyhow, that's basically it. That's basically it. It's kind of strange, you know, normally a person, men of the house and stuff, I mean, he's an old man, but... Normally, you know, if someone was like, you know, if I was visiting somewhere and banging on the door and then it's like, you know, I'll do anything to, you know, because, you know, it's inevitable. The battle's going to happen.
Mm.
So you put yourself in the mindset of I am going to kill if I have to, and I'm going to win this battle. And that's what normally people do. And this story is, now the thing is that this Levite is faded out. He's we don't hear anything from him. He's not having a discussion with him. He's just, you know, they're like looking at the door and everything. And, you know, we don't hear, they don't even say that. There's nothing from the Levite. The old man is having a discussion with them. And then suddenly the Levite acts. And what does he do? He walks up to his concubine, grabs her, thinking, well, she's anyhow worthless. She doesn't know how to cook. She burnt my food. She doesn't clean the house. And she ran away. And he throws her out to them.
Mm.
And this is like we're now seeing how nasty this person is. And that concubine should have been protected. But it's a reverse situation. He is the nasty guy. He is the bad guy. He should be the guy who gets what getting to him in the end of the story. Mm. But no, he gets up instead of protecting her, instead of pulling out a sword or something and saying, "No, you want a piece of this? Let's do this."
Mm.
He doesn't do that. He doesn't do anything. He just grabs her. Throws her out and says, whatever, sits down and continues eating.
You know, I got to agree. I have to agree. And look, there may be, you know, listeners might have different interpretations, but I tell you what, I agree, Yoel. I think he should have grabbed the sword, the baseball bat, the chainsaw, and just gone out and at least died trying to protect them all. And in any case, he uses her as the human shield, so to speak, and he throws her out to placate them. And it says they knew her and abused her all night until morning. They basically gang raped her all night. And when the day began to break, they let her go. And the woman came as the day was dawning, and she fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light at the door. I mean,
he doesn't even go out to see if everything's okay. He doesn't even, you said, an hour or two, she'll be fine. He doesn't even go out to see if everything's okay. He just goes to bed.
He goes to bed. And when master rose in the morning, he opened the doors of the house and he went to go on his way, and there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. Now, I don't want to read to him. I don't want to read anything into this, Yoel. Is there possibly any significance?
The guy's a sociopath.
With the threshold, is there anything?
It can be very symbolic that she her hand is on the threshold, and there's a symbolic idea here that she was under the protection of the house. She was under the protection of that village. And, no one did anything to try to help her. Mm-hmm. No one, naturally, if you're walking in the street and you see a bunch of punks, using certain terminology, but that's how we sometimes, when we used to train, we talked about attacking, if you have to protect someone, go into a fight against a group, then we just, talking in a certain terminology. Mm-hmm. But you walk in and you see a bunch of guys harassing this woman, I think at least with me, naturally the first thing you do is you look for the first weapon you can find if you have to and protect her. You have to, if you're a righteous person will get up and do something about it. And this is part of what's being said here. No one's doing anything. It wasn't just the issue of what these guys did. It's not just the issue of what this Levite's doing. It's also the attitude of the entire village. It's the attitude of the people in general. It's not just the individual story. It's the general thing, the general attitude of what people were doing. And this is the real criticism here, because they were doing in the middle of the village. Everyone can hear the screaming. Everyone can knows what's going on. No one's standing up to the bullies. If it's 5 people, 10 people. This could be 100 people in this village, 100 other men. If even 50 of them get up and get rid of these bullies, or even kill them if necessary, the problem would be solved. But these types of bullies were created because people didn't care. And I think that's really part of the criticism that's really brought here. This is why the story, it's not just this Levi, it's not just these bullies, it's not just the old man, it's not just this, it's the entire attitude that by forsaking Torah, by forsaking righteousness, groups like that, basically cancerous groups like that, start developing and flourishing inside society.
Yeah.
And I think that's the main issue of at least this chapter. It leads up to this.
Perhaps.
And so no one cares.
No one cares. And so he comes out, there she is, and this is it. He says, I'm sorry, are you okay?
He says to her, he walks out and says, get up, we're going.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Whenever, I remember the first time I read this, I shook my head like, what?
What? And then you're right. And then you revisit the beginning of the chapter and you go, this probably has something to do with the reason why she left for 4 months and maybe was not planning on coming back.
Exactly.
The guy is a
sociopath.
There we go.
It's really what it is.
I was going to use.
Well, I will tell you a little secret. I want to tell you an interesting thing that happened. So, a friend of mine posts on Facebook something that is by some people would be considered to be some kind of a cuss word. Now, he puts it up, and then a whole bunch of people start attacking him for saying that. So he talks to me, and he says to me, have you seen what's going on here? And I say, well, what do you mean? And I look at Facebook and I see this, and a lot of people, from the Messianic world or from the Christian world, start attacking him for this. And I tell him, but what's the problem? This word is harmless. And he said, yeah, but some people think it's a cuss word. So there's an interesting story. I'm going to skip for a second in for the Book of Samuel. And it talks about when King David runs off. David runs off and hides, and Jonathan sits in his seat, and David is missing first day and then the second day, and on the second day Saul goes and says, "Where's David?" And Jonathan says to David, "Well, he said that he has to go see his family. They have some kind of a ceremony or something. They're having some kind of festival there for them." And he turns around to him and says, "I know you choose this house of David and the son of Jesse to your shame and the shame of your mother's where you came from, basically."
Really?
He says, "Levoshtecha or levoshet ervati mecha." Now, in Arabic, there's a cuss word, which means the exact same thing. And I remember when I was studying this book with one of my rabbis, and he reached this verse and he smiled. And he said, this is the one of the only cases in the Bible where someone really cusses someone, but in a personal and a nasty way of cussing. And he said, there's two ways of reading this. You can either say, look at the bad behavior of King Saul, but if it was really problematic, they wouldn't have quoted it. He said that he thinks, and he said that in his opinion, when a cuss word is appropriate, when it's necessary, you actually use it. And I was sitting there going like, what? And I walked up to him after the lesson and said, Rabbi, are you serious? And he said, yes, when a cuss word is necessary to express something, or even if you by mistake say a cuss word, there's no sin in that. Yeah, there's nothing.
There's a moral dilemma. So the question becomes: is there a time where it's where the context demands the expression of such a word, the use of such a word, and is that a permit? Because I get in trouble. You know, I've been in trouble before, Yoel, because I might say something, and lo and behold, I find out that it's some kind of cuss word over in America, and I'm like, well, I didn't.
So again, if you and I make a mistake like that, people have to forgive us because we don't speak American English. You speak Australian English. I speak English. You know, there's a lot of influence of American English on my words. Yes, true. But I think one of the main things is that, first of all, in American speech, you know, Americans use a lot of cuss words, and I think it's too rough. I mean, I avoid cuss words as much as I can. My wife's father, for example, happens to be American. We spoke about this, and he did admit that there's too much cuss words in the American speech every day. In every everyday speech, and he avoids using cuss words as well. But I think, you know, if you by mistake say a cuss word, or when you outrage and you say something, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, let's be very, very serious. Fine comb the Torah. Show me one place where it says there's a prohibition of using cuss words. One place. Show me one place that it says that. You will not find anything.
So here's a question, and you know, I don't want to be going down a rabbit trail here, but is there? I mean, you've given one example, but was there really a concept of a vocabulary of cuss words in ancient Hebrew?
Obviously,
there was.
It was very elegant.
But was it used more as an expression of cursing, or was it actual words?
No, so it really depends. For example, in diplomacy, they used to have. I found these funny. These funny writings where the Pharaoh writes to this person, he tells him off, he's being really nasty to him, but he does it in a very elegant way. It's kind of funny. But I think in the everyday speech, there were cuss words. And I think cuss words have always been in existence in languages because when people want to say something nasty to someone, they'll say something about their family or something about their mother or whatever it is. And those things always exist. And I mean, look, lo and behold, King Saul does that. But he does it in a way where it doesn't sound that terrible. But again, the way words are used, I mean, really, really depends. I can take, for example, there's a word in Hebrew which means reinforced, and we say reinforced concrete. Mm-hmm. But we can take that word, and we can use it in a way where it's a cuss word. And I think, first of all, many cuss words that exist today are really, say, 400 years ago meant something completely different. Mm. You know, I think one of the classic ones, I don't know how many people actually know this, but for example, the famous four-lettered word used to mean something completely different.
Mm, sure.
You know, and I don't know how many people actually know that.
This is funny, actually, because it reminds me.
I think it's corruption. I think some cuss words are a corruption of...
Oh,
simple,
no doubt.
Everyday words. But I think most cussing, I mean, we do a whole discussion about how to cuss one another, but I think most cussing in the ancient world, I mean, for example, when you look at Arabs, how they do it, and look at it, it's mostly very personal. And you don't really have to say something nasty or something which is really not clean, but you can say something really, really nasty in a very, very clean way. Mm. And one of the other things we have, for example, in the Torah, we have places where the word was changed. For example, this week's parasha, which is people want to read it. By the time they hear this, it will be the week after. But in Kitavo, there are places where it actually uses. It says opening up, it says in 28 verse 30, it says, a woman you will betroth, but another man will lay with her. Now, in the written text, it says, Yishgelena, and a shagal was usually a partner just for intercourse. But the verse says, Yishkevena, and Yishkevena means to lay, from the root of shachav. Mm-hmm. And it's used, and some people say this word became a nasty word at one point, so they prefer to read it differently. In the text itself, you open a Torah scroll, you see the word Yishgelena, but it preferred to use a different word to avoid the uncomfortable, the using such a nasty word in public. But say hundreds of years before that, it was a perfectly normal word. And we have another example in the same place where it mentions in verse 27, it says God and God will strike you with the Shechin of Egypt. Shechin is the boils of Egypt, and the Ophalim. And the Ophalim are some type of hemorrhoids. Mm-hmm. But in the written, when we read it, we actually say Tchorim. And Tchorim are just regular hemorrhoids. So we see that certain words in time evolved into something which most people felt uncomfortable using. Mm-hmm. And I think this is also a sign that, you know, we're not supposed to use cuss words every day in everyday life. We're not supposed to, you know, the way a person speaks sometimes will be a sign of the person's character as well. Mm-hmm. A person uses a lot of cuss words, you know, it can be a kind of an insight into who the person is.
It kind of, you know, when people use a lot of cuss words in public, it goes to show the kind of respect they have for those mm-hmm. around them, I think, and also therefore the respect they have for themselves, and that's not necessarily a good thing. But I mean, if you slam your thumb with a hammer and you say something quite loudly, I mean, that I'm happy to forgive that. And in this case, in verse 28, if the listeners, you know, would like to choose from their list of colorful vocabulary and apply it to this particular Levite, I think the conclusion of our discussion here is that that's perfectly acceptable. And so the man, he lifts her onto the donkey, and the man got up and he went to his place. And when he entered his house, he took a knife. Now, we're to understand, Yoel, surely, between verse 28 and verse 29, somewhere along the way on the donkey, she dies if she wasn't already dead.
He wasn't even trying to help her. He's like, oh, okay, a sack of potatoes. Yeah. He puts her on the donkey and goes, and he doesn't even try to see if there's any way of helping her. You know, if she's exhausted, I mean, he might be able to save her life. You know, take her in, attend to her wounds.
Yeah, don't have any of that.
You know. Nothing. Yeah, he just nothing. You know, sack of potatoes, put on the donkey and goes away. I mean, this is horrible.
It is horrible. So whether she was already dead or she died on the donkey, he entered the house, he took a knife, he lay hold of his concubine and divided her into 12 pieces, 12, limb by limb, and sent her, although it doesn't say limb by limb, does it? What does it say in the Hebrew?
Ve'intachel atzameha, which means to her limbs. I mean, yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, I understand this, but it means limbs too, because the atzameha means her bones, which will mean he's cutting based on the limbs themselves.
Sure. And he sent, her pieces throughout all the territory of Israel, so we're to assume that he sent, you know, one piece to each tribe. And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up.
So it also could be, it says, Vayishalecheha b'chol gvul Yisrael. It always sounded as if he took the parts and tossed them. But I ask a very simple question. Okay, so you take a limb and you throw it in some field or something, you know, so it sounds as if he's throwing her limbs in different places, but it could be. I'm speculating, I'm actually looking through a book here just to see if I can find something which will prove what I'm saying, but it could be that he actually took the limbs themselves and mailed them. He sent them to That's the head impression. Of the tribes and basically said, look.
Check it out.
Because again, it doesn't sound like it, because it really shalecheha.
But does it suggest, does it suggest that there's something about the condition of her flesh, her skin, that speaks for itself? Is that what we're to understand?
There might have been, well, first of all, he's sending an actual, you know, you open up your mail and you find something like that. You go like, "What is this?" And they start. People will start. He's provoking the talk about this.
Right.
What is this? Why did I? You know, the head of the tribe receives, or the leaders of the tribe receive this package with a limb. You know, and it could be that some of them receive, you know, with not just, you know, the cut, but with signs of injury.
Mm.
So they can also see, besides that, the violence. But it doesn't really matter. The point is that they receive a limb, and everyone's like, what is this?
Mm.
Why did I receive a limb in the mail? And then they start asking, and people start spreading. The rumor spreads, and then discussion begins, and everyone is... So they say, okay, something's happened here, and there's a meeting. Everyone, there's decision to make a gigantic meeting.
Mm-hmm. And this is the beginning of Judges chapter 20, and it really demands that we go on, but we can't because we spent so much time schmoozing before, and there's so much in chapter 19 that we've really taken up our time, and the dear listeners are going to have to wait until next week to see. I mean, it does, the craziness doesn't stop there, Yoel. It really does continue into chapter 20, and we're going to have to get to that one next week. But for the listeners, again, Yoel Ben Shlomo, Yoel Halabi, we're going to be back next week discussing Judges chapter 20. And until then, dear listeners, get on Facebook and click on Hebrew in Israel and like it and engage with the information there. That's Yoel's Facebook page. And until then, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kol Tov.